And hello, everyone. This hour, we have a very, very interesting person by the name of Michael Flores, and he knows more about the low-budget B-movies. Actually, I guess, Michael, they'd be B-minus movies, wouldn't they?
Been that way in the past. These films began at the drive-ins, usually as low-to-no-budget features. But today, many of the big studios are making films that subject matter is pretty much the same as the drive-in movies.
That's right. We were talking a little bit off the air about that yesterday. This is Michael Flores, and welcome to the show, by the way, Michael.
Howdy. I'm the head of the Psychotronic Film Society in Chicago.
Yeah, now, you, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about this Psychotronic Film Society? You're pretty active in showing some of these movies. I noticed on your answering machine you had something going on.
Well, we have films and events on a weekly basis at nightclubs all over the Chicago area. Sometimes we show very obscure B-movies. Sometimes we have a mixture of a live event and a film. The director, Russ Meyer, was at a party that we threw for him at the Limelight here in Chicago, and that drew about 1,500 people. And we show films that aren't available on cable TV or at video stores that have been forgotten or the people that made them wanted to forget about them.
we'll get into that on how you find these movies in a moment. But first of all, before we get to what we were talking about when we opened the top of the show here about today's movies, that really fit your genre, I guess, and they're big budget movies now, but that wasn't always the case, was it?
Oh, no. A slasher horror film like Halloween had a budget of less than $1 million, although it did star in her first role, Jamie Lee Curtis, who certainly went on to bigger things. That's pretty much how the slasher-type horror film began, with that movie. And it is a good film, unlike the majority of the slasher films, which usually aren't very good. But I was pretty amazed when I saw the film The Silence of the Lambs, which had been described as being a thriller with cannibalism, that it was, in fact, a horror slasher film. It's a good one. It costs a lot of money to make. I guess when it's a budget question, they call it a thriller.
Well, probably when you go over that $1 million thriller.
Yeah. They don't like to call it a horror film anymore. But it is a very effective horror movie.
Now, why don't you tell us about this Film Society, how it started and exactly what it is you do?
Well, ever since I was a kid, I loved B-movies. I first saw King Kong from 1933 on television and immediately sympathized with Kong. I picked up horror magazines when I was growing up. While most of my friends were putting together models of hot rods and jets, I was putting together toy models of the Creature from the Black Lagoon and the Mole People.
Yeah, the Creature from the Black Lagoon had Julie, the girl in the white bathing suit. That was great. I can't think of her name right now. One of my favorite actresses. I don't know if she ever made any other movies or not. It goes back there. I can't think. Well, her name escapes me, but it's Julie somebody, and she had this white bathing suit, and she swam around in this movie, and the Creature would, of course, look at her a lot. And she had to,
Julia Adams.
Yeah.
Julia Adams, right. And the director of Creature from the Black Lagoon, Jack Arnold, later went on to direct television shows. He directed many of the episodes of The Brady Bunch.
That's a switch. Oh, maybe it isn't, now that I think about it.
Yeah, so he kept working with psychotronic material for quite a while. But I learned to love this stuff. I wasn't allowed by my parents to watch The Three Stooges, so I had to find ways to, like, sneak over to friends' houses and watch it when it was on. And then I began writing reviews of The Three Stooges shorts, hand-printing them on loose leaf paper at school, and I charged my classmates a nickel to read my reviews of The Three Stooges short, which basically could be summed up as being, I liked all the ones with Curly, and I hated all the ones with everybody but Curly.
Yeah, what happened to Curly? How come he dropped out there? Did he die, or what happened?
Yeah, he had a heart attack and passed away, and Shemp, who actually had been one of the original Three Stooges and was Moe's brother, took his place.
Hey, can you hold on? We've got to go do a break, Michael. When we come back, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the Three Stooges, and then let's get back to the Psychotronic, I'm sorry.
Psychotronic.
That's the title, right?
Sure.
And I got to find out more about that word. That intrigues me, okay?
All right.
This is This is Jerry Pippin, and we're back, and we have from Chicago with Michael Flores, who heads the group called the Psychotronic Film Society. And Michael, when we left for the break, we were talking about the Three Stooges. I guess they actually started back in vaudeville or something, didn't they? Ted Healy or something? Didn't they?
Right. Ted Healy put the act together and used Moe and Chimp Howard, who were brothers, and Larry Fine, and they toured around the country doing the vaudeville circuit. Ted Healy was right before they were to get their big Hollywood break. They had appeared in one film with Ted Healy and the Stooges. And it was before, you know, most Americans had seen them that Ted Healy got in a fight at outside of a bar. I think it's another Hollywood actor that he was involved in a fight with. We'll leave it at that. It was unsolved, so to speak. Healy died as a result of the beating, and the Three Stooges were forced to go on their own, which they almost didn't do. And Chimp was afraid that the Stooges wouldn't catch on, so he dropped out.
What did Chimp do when he dropped out?
Chimp Howard did his own shorts under his own name, so you could see at theaters they would show a Chimp Howard short. And I don't know, he wasn't as funny to me as Curly was.
Now, Curly came into the act at that time, Mo, Larry, and Curly.
Right, and of course, they weren't even sure how they'd be accepted because there was no straight man anymore.
Ted Healy's job was.
Right.
Be the straight man.
And no one had heard of a comedy act without a straight man.
So they were pioneers.
I guess. And you want to know the sad thing is, in all those years that they worked at Columbia making all those shorts, they never got a raise the entire time.
I don't think they made too much money.
No, they didn't, unfortunately. And they, when the shorts were sold to television, they didn't get any either.
Yeah, of course, at that point, there were no royalties at all on any kind of motion picture product, was there?
No.
Not for the...
So I was a kid, and I enjoyed all of this stuff. The interest stayed with me, and we began having parties about 7 years ago at our home, where we would invite people over and show all kinds of bizarre B-movies. And we discovered that a lot of our friends loved these films, too, even though it didn't really come up at the business office or over the dinner table too often. And eventually...
That's probably something you wouldn't want to brag about. There's some status there, I guess. And if you really like real lousy movies, but they're not really lousy, are they?
Not all of them.
Some of them are pretty good.
Yeah, the only bad film I've ever seen is one that bores me. But eventually we were getting several hundred people showing up at our door. And we realized it was getting out of hand, so we began having these events around town. Now, the word psychotronic, psycho as in horror, tronic as in electronic or science fiction, seemed to cover a lot of the drive-in type films, and is a word that had been in use since the early 1950s to describe ESP and telekinetic powers. And in the early 60s, a filmmaker named Jack Sell did a film called The Psychotronic Man, which is really a bad film, but...
It's one that bores you, then, huh?
Well, I've never seen the whole film all the way through, but I've tried.
You're falling asleep or what?
Yeah, something like that. And Jack Sells is now a big Hollywood TV commercial maker, but his first directorial job was really bad. And so Psychotronic seemed to fit, and we called ourselves the Psychotronic Film Society. The first few months we were in operation, we were visited by John Cleese, director Sidney Pollack, who did Tootsie, Bill Murray, who's been a member since we had started, and people from all over the country, because we began to find that there really wasn't anything like our film society anywhere else. And people began traveling to Chicago to come to these parties. So it's been a lot of fun.
So from that standpoint, you probably, then you started doing them, what, at nightclubs and other places?
Nightclubs, and we also published two magazines that are available at comic book stores and film memorabilia shops. One is called Thrillerama, and it covers all popular culture or trash culture, all the things that most people don't take very serious, from heavy metal to horror movies. And we also do a magazine called that magazine's called Thrillerama. We also do a magazine called Painted Faces, which is about the cinema of Hong Kong, where Bruce Lee and Jackie Chan are from. And those are probably the best action and adventure films being made on the planet today.
Are they still turning out those in Hong Kong?
Oh, sure. But, and most of them aren't seen by American audiences the way they were when Bruce Lee was around, but the films have actually gotten much better. Films like John Woo's The Killer.
There's a lot of people listening that I'm sure they'd like to get involved in something like
now,
that.
Now, when you saw Creature from the Black Lagoon, did you see it in 3D at the movie theater?
Yes, I did.
All right.
And yes. The water was everywhere.
I love the 3D in that movie. Did you see House of Wax?
Sure.
With Vincent Price?
Yes. Is that one of the movies listed by you?
Oh, I love that film.
Yeah, that was good. I didn't like the eyes part, so when the thing, you know, punched the eyes out or whatever there. In 3D, it was almost too realistic for me.
I like the way the wax melted in 3D.
Yeah, that was good.
They're talking about bringing 3D to television, which I think will be exciting.
Yeah, it'll be a little different. Everything from Bawana Devil on, I guess that was the first 3D movie. I remember the guy throwing the spear out, and it was a black and white 3D movie of a guy falling off a roller coaster or something. I don't know.
Arch Obler, who used to do a lot of the Lights Out and Suspense radio shows, was involved in the making of the early 3D films.
Hmm.
A lot of these films used gimmicks.
Let's talk about that when we get back. Let's take a break here.
Yeah.
And when we come back, let's explain. There's probably a large part of our audience that does not realize that before CinemaScope and widescreen, the movies tried something else to combat television. It was called 3D. I'm Jerry Pippin. We'll be back in a moment. Talking about 3D movies right now, he's the head of the Psychotronic Film Society. Michael, we might, for those people that are not familiar with 3D, it was kind of an interesting system. I guess they used two cameras, they strapped them together or something?
They would
two lenses straight into one. I don't know. What you explain it how it worked? I'm sure you know. You follow all these things.
All right. There was a red and a blue filtered projector, and they were both supposed to be linked together and shown on a special screen. Some theaters tried to save money by using the regular screen, which would give people headaches. Other people who used the equipment correctly would get a real nice three-dimensional effect. And in the 1950s, a lot of the small film companies or smaller budgeted films would try to come up with a gimmick that wasn't available on TV or being used by the big studios yet. And Arch Obler, who'd come out of radio, experimented with 3D in the Bawana film you talked about. And
right, yeah, he had a program called Lights Out.
Right, and his 3D was fairly crude. By the time it got to the Creature from the Black Lagoon, the big studios were using it. But even then, if the theater owner didn't use the right kind of screen, you'd have an audience of people with a headache. Nowadays, of course, they're developing 3D that won't even need glasses. So that could be pretty interesting. But in the 50s, in the middle 50s, they had to come up with a gimmick.
Yeah, because television really had started wiping out movie audiences completely, hadn't it?
Yes, it had. And they were so afraid of television that they didn't start selling their movies to TV until almost 1960. They were trying to keep TV from catching on. But there were also people like William Castle out there who couldn't even afford 3D. So he would come up. On one film, he had House on a Haunted Hill, where he developed something called Perceptovision. Now,
good name.
Right.
I don't remember this. Tell me about it.
Well, what he did was he took a plastic skeleton and put it on top of the screen, tied it to a fish line that went to the projectionist booth, and during a certain scene in the film, this plastic skeleton would rattle over the heads of the audience. That was Perceptovision.
Yeah, somebody had some tickler seats or something in the audience on some movie.
That was William Castle. He did a film called The Tingler.
That was it.
And he put wires in about 20 seats in each theater so that during a certain time the projectionist could push a button and there would be a buzzing noise to make people yell. And he also told the theater owners, if no one yelled by at least halfway through the movie, to have one of the ushers pretend to be a customer and pass out in the theater. so that they could cut on the lights and carry this person out to make it look like they had been scared into fainting.
In fact, I guess there were a whole lot of twins like that. If I remember, there was even a movie of Smell-O-Vision or something in it. Well, was that
yeah.
Well, hey, can you hold on, Michael? We got to go for a few seconds. We'll
all right.
About 3 minutes, and let's get on back to the Psychotronic Film Society. Great ideas and great information coming from Michael Flores. And across the coast, this is Gary Pippen. We have Michael Flores in Chicago on the line for us. He's head of a group called the Psychotronic Film Society. And Michael, if it's okay with you, I'd like to open up the phones. Maybe we'll take some questions here later, okay?
Sure, fine.
If you have a question about B movies, and some of them maybe are C or D movies as far as that goes. What was the cheapest movie ever made that you know of?
Well, one of my favorites came in for around $20,000, and that's a film called Plan 9 from Outer Space. And that was made by a man named Ed Wood. Ed Wood was Hollywood's greatest transvestite director.
He literally was, huh?
Yes, and he actually bragged that at the Battle of Iwo Jima, he had been wearing women's undergarments under his Marine outfit.
So he was a Marine.
Yes, and he also got an award for his...
What, for wearing the underwear?
No, for being a valor fighter. At any rate, Ed Wood did this film, Plan 9 from Outer Space, with Bela Lugosi and Tor Johnson. Now, it was Bela Lugosi, it was his last film. He died 2 days into filming Plan 9. So Ed Wood immediately hired someone who was 40 years younger, about 5 inches taller, and had a mustache to pretend to be Bela Lugosi for the rest of the movie. He also had in the film the Swedish wrestler, who was very popular in the early 50s and even appeared on Groucho Marx's You Bet Your Life show, Tor Johnson. And Tor Johnson played a Mew who had risen from the dead. We never actually find out what the other Plan 8 were.
What the other 8 plans were.
Yeah,
we go straight to Plan 9.
Plan 9. And in Plan 9, beings from a spaceship, which looks exactly like a car hubcap.
Probably was.
That's right. plot bringing the dead back to life to raise war against the living so that they can take over planet Earth. And the film, even though it is completely incoherent and goes from morning to evening within one scene, is a lot of fun and is a good time.
Now, when you play these at nightclubs around Chicago, what type of movies are the most popular? I mean, what do you get the most drawn?
Well, we have a women's auxiliary, and the women's auxiliary of the Film Society show films that basically degrade and humiliate men.
And this is kind of Thelma and Louise on an earlier plane, huh?
That's right. They show films like Switchblade Sisters, Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill, and usually scream their enjoyment when men are destroyed on the screen. They also do things like go to films, Fried Green Tomatoes,
mm-hmm.
where no male in the film is actually degraded, humiliated, or killed, and they will yell the ending out loud to the people waiting in line.
Well, they have an agenda.
They have an agenda. I don't know what it is. Men are allowed to go to their shows, which are usually girl gang on a rampage type films, and those films are, for some reason, people enjoy them. I, for one, am afraid of what happens to people who watch those kind of films, but I can't stop the women from putting them on.
Now you have been watching strange movies all your life. Have you noticed anything different in your lifestyle or your...
Well, the fact that I'm talking to you on the radio.
You got a good point. We'll go to the next question. Hey, Michael, what kind of movies would fit into this Psychotronic Film Society? I guess we talked about Kung Fu just briefly. I guess everything from Kung Fu to all-girl gangs, obviously.
Or women in prison films. There's a good genre.
Oh, yeah, that was kind of big for a couple of years there.
In the early 70s, a young director was hired by Roger Corman to go out and do films about women being held in prison camps, usually wearing hot pants and shirts that tied up somewhere.
Yes.
And that director was a man by the name of Jonathan Demme, who years later repaid Roger Corman by giving him a role in The Silence of the Lambs.
Interesting, so, little trivia or sidebar.
He actually began the sort of B bimbo in prison camp movie.
Now, Roger Corman is, you know, you can't talk about this type of movie genre without mentioning his name.
Oh, that's right. In the 1950s, he did miracle films. It was a miracle they were made, and it was a miracle they were shown. But he always put a lot of creativity in his work when he began. And so you always knew the man had some idea of quality, which not everyone who worked in those kind of films really cared about. His early films, for example, like The Little Shop of Horrors, 30, 40 years later, could be updated, made into a musical, and be just as big a hit as his cheap movie was. And Roger Corman gave a lot of people their first chance when no one would even consider them. He let Martin Scorsese, who did Goodfellas and so many excellent movies, direct his first film, Boxcar Bertha, for him. And he's worked with actors like Dennis Hopper, Jack Nicholson. He gave all of them their first break.
Corman these days could afford to make an expensive movie if he wanted to, right?
Oh, yeah, but, you know, why?
Yeah, why do it? I imagine this movie, the Plan 9 from Outer Space, at $20,000 as a total budget, it probably made money right off, huh?
Well, it's funny, you know, to get the $20,000 to make the film, they decided to ask a Baptist church in Los Angeles for the money. So the Baptist church said, well, we'll give you the $20,000, but you have to be baptized. So try to imagine the entire cast and crew, Bela Lugosi, Ed Wood, Tor Johnson, Vampira, who was a horror hostess in Los Angeles, and all these wacky and bizarre people going into a swimming pool outside of Los Angeles to be baptized, and then they got the $20,000 to make the movie.
Maybe that's the reason Bela Lugosi died. Maybe caught cold or something.
Well, I don't know. He was already fairly old at that point, so I'm not really sure.
So there's got to be a whole lot of interesting stories on how these people raise the money to start making these things. I mean, you don't walk into a bank and say, I'm going to make Plan 9 from Outer Space.
That's right. Well, the main actor looks like he's going to die. That won't stop this film.
We'll prop him up. You mentioned Russ Meyer earlier, didn't you?
Yes.
Yes. Tell us a little bit about him these days.
We did.
I remember Vixens.
Oh, sure. We did. First of all, I should tell your audience that doesn't know, if I can find a way to euphemistically say it, Russ Meyer does films that are about Amazonian-type women.
With big...
Very large.
Right.
Very large. Not just
right.
Big, but yeah. Very large. I'd say torsos, let's say. And
actually, it was Beneath the Valley of the Ultra Vixens. Was that the sequel to Vixens? Or?
Oh, no, it was its own entity. It was its own movie, and that was also written by Roger Ebert, who's collaborated with Russ Meyer on...
Roger Ebert, the movie critic?
That's right.
He wrote this movie?
They've worked together on 4 films. And I guess they must share an interest in something. But
now, this will give me a whole new a slant when the next time I see Ebert knocking
right.
a movie.
That's right. The films are excellent, though. And
he made 4 of them. He wrote 4 of them?
He wrote 4 of Russ Meyer's films. Russ has probably made over 30 movies, from Faster Pussycat Kill Kill to Lorna to Beneath the Valley of the Ultra Vixens.
When we come back on the next segment, I got to explore this a little bit more. Can you hold on? We'll be back. We're talking to Michael Flores. This is Jerry Pippin. I've got to follow up on this Russ Meyer situation with Roger Ebert. Beneath the Valley, the Ultra Vixens, if I remember, wasn't that the one about the well-endowed female rock stars fighting? Who were they fighting? The
transsexual. They were fighting a transsexual.
Brian Ellis at Studio Control here is a big Russ Meyer fan, and he would have flown to Chicago to take part in this. What was it, a Russ Meyer festival or something you had?
Well, we had a big party for Russ. Over 1,500 people attended it.
Yeah, you mentioned that at the top of the hour.
And we showed clips from his films. Mr. Meyer, who was really nice, Russ Meyer's walked out and talked to people in the audience. He apparently is working on an 8-hour-long movie called... Get the Breast of Russ Meyer, and Roger Ebert has written that as well.
You're kidding me. Roger's still writing for this guy?
You better believe it.
Ha, ha.
And I don't know if he's still using his real name, but he is. And we also had a Leave It to Cleavage contest, which had about 30 participants, and a woman won. So it was a fun time.
Yeah, it sounds like a fun party. Now, Brian says his favorite one was Super Vixen. I didn't see that one.
Oh, yeah. All of his Vixen movies did great, were a big hit for him.
But he made about 30 movies altogether.
Right, and they mostly played at drive-ins. And because he had a sense of humor, his films played to largely couple audiences, to couples.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of women saw Russ Meyer's films at the
drive-in. In other words, it just wasn't a house full of degenerates.
Oh, no, he didn't do, like, hardcore films.
No, this was artistic stuff, kind of...
Well, I don't know if artistic is the word.
Well, it like Barbarella.
Yeah.
You may be right. Maybe artistic isn't the word, now that I think about it. But
Barbarella,
it,
Jane Fonda's greatest movie.
Yeah, I really thought so.
Yeah.
Somehow she got sexual enjoyment by touching her finger to people. Or so, I don't remember exactly what the deal was. But.
I don't know, but I've been trying to develop that power.
Now, we've been talking about a lot of movies out of the past, and as you alluded to earlier in the show, the big budget movies like Silence of the Lambs really would qualify.
Oh, yeah. Nowadays, what would have been a low-budget science fiction film in the 50s or 60s is a $48 million Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, but it's still basically the same plot.
Well, we haven't covered other categories. Let me see. How about the black exploitation movies like Shaft? Do they qualify?
Well, they
or is that too good of a movie?
I would say that the black exploitation films of the 70s, Rudy Ray Moore doing Dolomite and Superfly and all of those films were definitely played to the inner city, to the cities of America, the same way drive-in movies played to the suburbs at drive-ins. They're still being made today, which is kind of neat. The low-budget independent film is now still coming from black filmmakers. Boys in the Hood and films like that were really low budget and are good, by the way. If your audience is wondering whether they should rent them at the video store, they really should. Anything with iced tea in it is pretty good. But those films with rap music are playing to the same emotions that the rock and roll movies did in the late 50s to their audience. And
that brings up a whole new area, too. I remember the Beach Boy movies and all those things.
Oh, yeah. There were a lot of really great beach films and go-go-go movies and mini skirts and rock bands like Eric Burdon and the Animals playing. But they spoke to teenagers, and a lot of the rap music now and a lot of the films that are coming out now are the same thing. They are able to articulate what people feel but can't always let the media know. So I would say the black films being made today have really kept the better parts of the drive-in theater alive. And the big studios will distribute them, but they don't really put a lot of money into them. Rap music, for example, sells millions and millions and millions of dollars worth of records without airplay and with limited video release. And even then, when they make a music video for a rap act that's selling 3 to 5 million copies, they spend less money on their video than a white act that sells 100,000 or 200,000 copies.
It's phenomenal.
So a lot of these bands are overcoming obstacles when they make it. And so while there are people who worry about the rap music and the black films coming out today, I think it's really healthy and it's really good that it's out there.
Now, Michael, since you brought this up, we're talking to Michael Flores here of the Psychotronic Film Society in Chicago. Do you feel that you're doing something that's socially redeeming?
Sometimes, once in a while. Not very often. What we do is we remind people that these things are good and that there is good stuff. You know, probably 70% of all movies ever made stink, I would guess.
That's right. Now you have two magazines out right now, Thrillerama, and actually, I guess they come out, what, 3 times a year, you said?
Right. Each one does Thrillerama and Painted Faces.
And the Painted Faces is about the Kung Fu type movie.
Right. The film's being made in Hong Kong.
This is Jerry Pippen again. We've heard about the great B-movies of all time, so now let's invite good friend Bobby Sessions, a comedian who's visiting us here off mic. Bobby, why don't we salute old-time radio? One of the stock bits in the 30s, 40s, even the early 50s of radio comedy shows was the use of the tongue twister or the rhyming lines. It was an effort to always trip up the comics. Bobby Sessions, as our guest, I guess you're going to help us demonstrate this ploy, right? Now, let me see. You're going to be the celebrity guest.
Droopy, the cartoon dog.
A chicken plucker at Peter Piper's chicken plucking plant?
Right, that's Peter Piper's chicken plucking plant, which is next to Porky's pig pit.
Peter Piper's chicken plucking plant next to Porky's pig pit in Piedmont?
Right, see, he was the speediest poultry plucker of them all at Peter Piper's chicken plucking plant next to Porky's pig pit in Piedmont.
What's the poor pitiful person's name?
Well, this poor pitiful person's name?
Mm-hmm.
Perry Potter.
Perry Potter?
Right.
Was he a pugilist?
As a matter of fact, Perry Potter was a pugilistic poultry plucker. Unfortunately, he picked the pugilistic pairing with a pal poultry plucker, who promptly popped the poop out of him.
Now let me get this straight. Perry Potter was a pugilistic poultry plucker who worked at Peter Piper's chicken plucking plant next to Porky's Big Pit in Piedmont. He picked the pugilistic pairing with a pal poultry plucker who promptly popped the poop out of him.
Perfect.
Believe it or not.
Let's go to the phones quickly.
Hello, is this Jerry Pippin?
Yes, as a matter of fact, it is.
Okay, I just wanted to call and let you know, I thought you got the best show in two states.
Well, thank you. What state?
Mental depression.
Oh, hey, wait a minute. I think you're drugged.
Don't tell me you're psychic, too.
I just can't believe you're calling me up and berating me like this.
Well, it's a nasty job, but somebody's got to do it.
Maybe.